Greetings and welcome to the first of three segments in this interview series with Maggie Mullen on the topic of DBT and psychosis. Maggie is a prominent psychotherapist in California and the author of the DBT Therapy Skills Workbook for Psychosis Disorder. In the first segment of this interview, Maggie uses a fictitious client, Sandra, as a case study to explain how she would conduct her first DBT session with a client presenting with psychotic symptoms. Starting with a chain analysis, Maggie explains a variety of DBT skills which she might teach Sandra, including the following: self-soothing skills, distraction skills, pros and cons, self-validation, and the STOP acronym. Next, Maggie explores the vicious cycle between emotional dysregulation and psychotic episodes, as well as the importance of DBT emotion regulation skills in breaking the cycle. Finally, Maggie also discusses some practical tips for teaching mindfulness skills to this population. Throughout this segment, Maggie emphasizes the need to make skills work as concrete as possible when working with symptoms of psychosis. Good morning, Maggie. So good to have you join us.
Thanks so much for having me, Kirby. I'm excited to be talking with you all a little more.
I would like to briefly introduce you. Maggie is a clinical social worker, a national trainer, and community activist with over a decade of experience helping people navigate psychosis. And that's precisely the reason for the interview today. Maggie is also the author of the DBT Skills Workbook for Psychosis. How did you become acquainted with DBT in the first place? And then as a follow-up question, how did you decide to specialize in psychosis?
I learned about DBT prior to starting graduate school, and that was when I was working with people who were being unnecessarily institutionalized in medical and psychiatric facilities. I'll say the thing that really drew me to DBT, having learned about it in that setting, was that it was developed by and for somebody with lived experience of severe emotion dysregulation problems. In recent years, Dr. Marsha Linehan spoke a lot about her struggles with suicide, cutting, and hospitalizations, and it really speaks to me as a model of having personal investment and commitment to the population that she served. I think of that personally as a powerful model for the work that I do. I also really love the fact that it's based in helping people build a life worth living, which is a really powerful concept. Rather than just simply doing suicide prevention with the goal of keeping people alive, DBT is really about giving people a reason to fight for their lives and a reason to do the work and stay motivated. Since you asked about why I decided to specialize with psychosis, I began working with people with psychosis, specifically seeing the really huge health disparities this population faces. People with psychosis face significantly greater stigma, and they deal with massive barriers to employment and housing, high rates of suicide, self-harm behavior, trauma, substance abuse, you name it. Really more so than any other group, people with psychosis are overlooked by the mental health field until fairly recently. When you look at most research studies for treatments, you'll find there's a rule out for psychosis. This has really resulted in emphasis almost exclusively on psychiatric medication for this population and avoiding doing any real psychotherapy or skill building with clients. This has really been true up until the last 15 or 20 years when CBT for psychosis became more widely available, but there's still really very little offered in the way of psychotherapy to people with psychosis. I feel like I've really had the privilege of working with people with psychotic spectrum disorders and the opportunity to help them and their loved ones get the culturally responsive treatment that they deserve and might not otherwise get.
You're right, Maggie. There is a huge need with this population, and there's not a ton of you out there doing this kind of work. The mental health field is especially fortunate to have you.
That's very kind. Thank you.
I can relate to your journey in terms of how you became enamored with DBT and DBT world. I think it was in 2011 that Dr. Marsha Linehan went back to the Institute of Living in Hartford, Connecticut, where she had been a patient herself as an adolescent. But in 2011, she went back and gave a speech in which she self-disclosed, I think publicly for the first time ever, her own struggles. I totally agree. That's exactly why I like DBT so much. The story of the founder of the model gives the model itself lots of credibility.
I absolutely agree.
Is there a case example that you would like to share as we go through the interview?
Yes. So I'll go ahead and read through this case if that's okay.
Sure.
Sandra is who we're going to be talking about today, is a 35-year-old pansexual Black cisgender woman. And she's diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder and has a history of multiple hospitalizations for manic episodes and suicide attempts. She sometimes self-harms in the form of cutting her legs and punching herself to try to get her voices to stop. She works full-time as a library assistant at the local library and lives in a multi-generational household with her family. She has support from her parents and grandparents, but they're feeling burned out with her due to the highs and lows of her behavior and moods recently. She currently has a partner and their relationship is also up and down. That's to set the scene, and she comes into your most recent session and shares that she got into a screaming fight with her mother that morning. Before the fight, she tells you that she became suspicious that her family had bad intentions toward her, and she saw her mom wringing her hands. After the fight, she shares that she began hearing voices or auditory hallucinations criticizing her and telling her what a bad person she is, and she decided to cut herself.
Maggie, what's the first thing you would do with this patient?
The first thing that I would do with anyone who came into a session as standard with DBT after they've self-harmed is a behavior chain analysis. And a behavior chain analysis is really a way of looking at the links in the chain of what led up to a target behavior. What were the thoughts, feelings, and emotions, body sensations, and behaviors that led her to the point of feeling like she had no other option than to self-harm? The first step with a behavior chain with Sandra in this case is really just to assess her emotional vulnerabilities, meaning what are the things that might predispose her to being more emotional that day? Has she eaten enough? Did she sleep enough the night before? Is she in physical pain? Has she used any substances? Things that tend to make us, again, feel more emotional. She might share with me that she hadn't eaten all day and she slept poorly the night before, making it more likely she will be more emotional that day. The next step here we would do is to outline all the links in the chain to understand again what were the different pieces that led to her performing that target behavior. The first step with that is to look at what are her attempts to be skillful. What did she already do or attempt to do to try to manage her emotions, and really looking at, was it effective, weighing the consequences of what happened? In Sandra's case, she might share with me that she tried to leave the conversation, but wasn't able to because she kept getting drawn back in. We might look at, was that actually an effective strategy in that moment? Next, we might look then at, based on everything that we've seen of this behavior, what could she do in the future to be more skillful? Meaning specifically noting areas where she might integrate some specific DBT skills or principles. With psychosis, we really want to make the skills as concrete and easy to use as possible. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. First, we might start by just having her notice that she's feeling escalated and suspicious of her family. We would use mindfulness, just the practice of checking in with yourself to notice that she's feeling that way. And then also the distress tolerance skill of stop, which stop is literally about stopping the action of what's happening and taking a step back so we can see the bigger picture. I might then have Sandra practice some self-validation, noticing I'm feeling afraid and just being able to say that to yourself to acknowledge your emotions that are there. Next thing we would look at is things that would help Sandra de-escalate herself. Could she have used self-soothing skills, for example, like drinking a warm cup of tea and listening to her favorite music, or going for a walk in her local park to help calm the fear that she noticed coming up around her mom? We could also use something like distraction skills from distress tolerance to take her mind off of her worries, maybe for half an hour, to let those emotions again de-escalate from that intense level. Could she have done maybe a pros and cons list to think about whether it was useful to believe her original thought that her family was out to get her? We're getting creative here. Sandra, we're going to have come up with her own solutions, and we're going to offer ideas and coach her to get there. The idea with all this is really just to set Sandra up to know how she can get through this situation more skillfully in the future, because it's likely that it will come up again, given the pattern that she's noticed in her life.
That's a lot of turf covered. And I'll admit, Maggie, I love the behavior chain precisely for all the reasons you just implied. No matter what walks in the door, no matter what the situation is, you can a lot of times start off with the behavior chain and then from there go in many different DBT directions.
Yes.
As the case may be. I notice you alluded to the STOP skill. I also really like that a lot. If I understand the STOP skill correctly, that's an acronym, and it stands for stop, take a step back, or in some versions, take a deep breath, observe what's going on, and then proceed mindfully. So we're definitely going to talk more about mindfulness in a little bit. But for now, you seem to focus quite a bit on emotions as you were discussing this particular behavior chain. Those of us that are familiar with DBT, we know that DBT was originally designed with borderline personality disorder in mind. And at the core of borderline personality disorder, there is this element of emotion dysregulation, but I didn't necessarily associate emotion dysregulation with psychosis. That's a pretty fascinating point you've been making there. Do you mind elaborating on that a little bit more?
Absolutely. Let's start with just the basics of CBT for psychosis for a second, and we'll move into that. CBT for psychosis really was developed with the idea of helping people with psychosis deal with the thoughts particularly associated with psychosis, which then in turn influence emotional world and behavioral world. What I've really found useful about that modality is that it gives us some tools to do that. But what tends to be missing is the concrete skills and interventions that DBT offers when people are emotionally dysregulated. What ends up happening is people with psychosis often get caught in this really vicious cycle where their strong emotions make it more likely that their symptoms will worsen than that their symptoms tend to cause their emotions to escalate even more. And we get stuck in, again, in this vicious cycle. If we're looking at Sandra, we might talk about the idea that she's feeling really stressed and ashamed in a situation where she got reprimanded at work, for example. And as a result, this increase in emotion she's feeling of stress and shame is that she's also then going to be experiencing more emotions. She's more likely to hear distressing voices, and they might be really critical to her, for example, or say things to her like, you can't trust anyone. For somebody with psychosis, these voices might make her feel afraid and maybe even angry now too. So the cycle continues where her suspicious thoughts and fearful emotions are increasing, and maybe end with her self-harming or isolating herself. It's a cycle that we work on breaking using DBT skills. And for a long time, clinicians and researchers assumed that people experiencing psychosis didn't feel emotions in the same way as other people because they didn't show it through their body language or affect. When we think of that flat affect some people with psychosis or schizophrenia experience. But what we now know is that's really untrue. And people with psychotic spectrum disorder struggle a lot with emotion regulation. Actually, that negative or what we call challenging emotions are actually consistently associated with an increase in paranoid thinking. And they're a predictor of paranoid episodes for this population. That's one thing we really want to keep in mind is that the relationship between emotions and psychotic symptoms is circular. If we're able to break that cycle using DBT skills, we have better outcomes for people rather than just focusing on thoughts or medication-only interventions.
That is so fascinating because we tend to think of psychosis as a thought disorder. That's how it's typically conceptualized. Traditional CBT world is all about dealing primarily with thoughts, right? We target thoughts, cognitive behavioral therapy. What I love about DBT is even though DBT fits within the framework of this broader CBT paradigm, what DBT says is no, we don't only just focus on thoughts. We also need to focus on emotions. And so emotions, in my opinion, it was the missing link in CBT world until DBT came along. Yeah, I'm tracking with you. That's another one of the reasons I love DBT is because let's assume someone does have problematic thought patterns. You can still intervene by focusing on the emotions.
Yes, definitely.
DBT gives you that option that you won't necessarily have with other CBT models.
Yes. And I think to point to this piece, Marsha Linehan in her original 1993 book, the sort of red book that we think of as our DBT bread and butter, she talks about the idea that in order to include people with psychosis when you do DBT, you just need to determine if the client has any cognitive impairments that would affect their ability to attend to or grasp skills concepts. It's there in the original text. One of the things that I've even found, given the changes since 1993, now it's been a few decades, is that people actually really can manage these skills when we use them in an adaptive way, even if they have cognitive impairments. So that's part of what my work is on, is adapting DBT skills to be appropriate for people with psychosis. Again, so that they're really concrete, very tangible. And take into account things like if clients have a lot of negative symptoms, which might mask their outward emotional expression, we take approaches that are going to help them either express verbally how they're feeling so other people can understand, and we work on helping them identify their emotions using mindfulness practice. We make small tweaks to make these skills work for this population who might not otherwise have those skills quite as accessible to them.
Great. And I want to hear all about those adaptations that you've been making as we go along here. But just by the way, parenthetically, I was also trained on that red book when I first started out as an intern, too long ago for me to admit here publicly. That red book was also my starting point with DBT. You've mentioned mindfulness a couple times already, particularly with that stop skill, and you just mentioned it again. How do you apply mindfulness to this population? That seems like a little bit of a challenge to me.
Yes, there are a lot of specific adaptations that we can make that make mindfulness work really well for people with psychosis. There is a really strong evidence base for helping people with psychosis using mindfulness, of kind of the acceptance-based approach of, rather than trying to challenge your symptoms, you're in turn accepting them. It doesn't mean that you like them or that they're okay, but just noticing them for what they are before you do anything. The ways that we apply mindfulness to this population is we start with things like a shorter time frame. Rather than maybe the recommended 40 minutes of an eyes closed, quiet mindfulness meditation, we maybe do really short chunks. It depends on your client's capacity, but I usually start with like 3 minutes or so with somebody that I'm working with. And sometimes we increase that or decrease that depending on, again, somebody's ability to just be aware of their surroundings as well as their internal world. We also offer more guidance than silent time. One of the recommendations for mindfulness in this population is being able to, rather than having them sit there again with their eyes closed, reflecting quietly, we walk them through more steps than we normally would. And that guidance should also include specific mention of psychotic symptoms in a normalizing way. I'll give you an example. In a typical mindfulness, if you notice your thoughts taking you away from the subject, bring your attention back to your breath. With somebody with psychosis, I'm also going to say something like, if you notice any voices that are taking your attention away from this activity or maybe starting to feel distressing, bring your attention back to your breath or to whatever it is that we're focusing on right now. The idea of doing that is just to normalize somebody's experience that would be happening to them because that's the reason they're coming in to see you in the first place. The last adaptation that I often make is the part of being able to focus not just on yourself, if that's too overwhelming. For example, if somebody is feeling really overwhelmed by intrusive thoughts, distressing voices, paranoia, whatever it is, I have people focus on the outward world instead. Describe and observe things in the room around them instead, rather than focusing on, you know, their breath or something happening internally.
That's fascinating. And actually, I make one of those adaptations for my clients as well, even though I'm not working with psychosis. One of the adaptations is that the shorter period of time. I found that works really well for a lot of my clients. A lot of my clients don't have the luxury to just sit around and do a formal meditative practice half hour a day. I teach them little mindfulness skills that they can sprinkle throughout their day. If you're washing dishes, take 2-3 minutes of your dishwashing time to do that mindfully. If you're stuck in traffic, might as well turn that into a mindfulness practice. If they can do that, just brief periods of mindfulness throughout the day, guess what? Now they are actually applying mindfulness to their daily lives, which is the whole point anyway.
I absolutely agree.
It just kind of struck me as you were talking that in a way, kind of a paradoxical way, people with psychosis might have a slight advantage in that when I'm teaching mindfulness to a lot of my clients, and I tell them, you know, to focus on a specific activity or whatever, and if any thoughts come up, any emotions, any distractions in the environment or any memories or whatever, just notice it, let it go, and then come back to the activity. Well, a lot of times they're not even aware of all of these thoughts and emotions that are popping up. It takes them time to be aware that a lot is going on in their mind. Whereas with someone with psychosis, they probably know, you know, a certain voice.
Yeah. So it depends on somebody's level of insight. I think there are folks for whom that is more of a challenge and we have to do more work on the noticing and mindfulness side of the practice. For some people, when that just becomes too overwhelming with psychosis, we just move on to something else that's going to be more useful for them in the moment. And maybe we try to circle back to that again later on.
Something that I imagine might be even more challenging with the population you work with is this whole idea of this non-judgmental stance. I know that's hard enough for the population I work with. I tend to work with survivors of trauma. How do you take a non-accepting stance when you have a voice telling you to go kill yourself because you're a worthless slut or whatever? How do you take a non-judgmental stance with that?
In an example like that, we might start even beyond the non-judgmental stance with something like being able to use distress tolerance skills first. Because, for example, if you have a voice saying something that's that criticizing or that harsh towards you, we might need to just start with de-escalate the emotions that are going to initially pop up, because that's common for people, right? You hear a voice saying something like that to you, it's going to be hard. We might start with something like distress tolerance. Once we've de-escalated slightly, then we work on the non-judgmental stance part, which is really a key component of mindfulness, of course. One of the reasons that this skill can be really handy in a situation like this is because it's so easy to jump to either believing the self-critical voice saying that to you, or because we might judge ourselves for having voices in the first place, the idea that there's something wrong with us or that we're not okay. When we can take a non-judgmental stance towards a voice like that, it can often reduce the overall emotional intensity in the situation and encourage that client to be gentle with themselves in that moment. So being less critical and more thoughtful towards yourself in that moment. In a specific circumstance like what you are naming, I might have that client focus in first on just observing and describing what just happened. What did I notice as my experience in my body or my mind coming up when I heard that voice say that to me? Are there specific strategies I can use that are associated with psychosis specifically as an adjunct? Can I actually communicate back to the voice and say, no, I don't believe that? Or can you come back later another time? There are ways that we can adapt specifically to voices to make them more gentle with us than they may be normally.
Another point I want to follow up on is how you mentioned that sometimes you need to do distress tolerance before you can do mindfulness. I really like how in DBT, mindfulness skills and distress tolerance skills are very similar. They overlap a lot and they go hand in hand. I like to think of distress tolerance as applied mindfulness. For example, you can do breathing as strictly a mindfulness exercise, but you could also do breathing as a distress tolerance exercise. And sometimes mindfulness itself is distress tolerance, but sometimes you need to do some kind of distress tolerance in order to become mindful, kind of as a prerequisite.
Yeah. And I think one thing to add to what you're sharing that I think is right on is there is some form of mindfulness that usually comes before distress tolerance, just only in the sense of knowing that you're escalated and need to use distress tolerance skills. They do go hand in hand, I think, in that regard.
Yeah, it's a circle. They both support each other. It's a dance they both do with each other. There are three main points from this section. First, even though psychosis has been historically conceptualized as a thought disorder, there's actually a strong correlation between emotion dysregulation and psychotic episodes. Therefore, emotion regulation work needs to be prioritized within DBT treatment for psychotic symptoms. Second, when teaching DBT skills to clients with psychosis, it's important to normalize psychotic symptoms and make skills work as concrete and user-friendly as possible. When teaching mindfulness skills in particular, it's especially important to have clients practice in very small time segments, for example, just a few minutes at a time, in contrast to longer or more traditional meditative practices. And third, clients are encouraged to practice mindfulness with their own inner psychotic experiences, such as delusions and hallucinations. However, if this is too triggering, they can also practice mindfulness on something more tangible or grounding in their external physical environment.